Welcome to Talent Hub Talk. I'm Ben Duncombe, and on this podcast, I will be interviewing prominent and inspirational figures from both the local ANZ and global Salesforce Ohana. In today's episode, we are joined by Cameron Cronin. Cameron is a Salesforce certified technical architect and a principal director for Accenture in the UK. Cameron is from Australia originally, so it was really interesting to hear more about his time in the Salesforce market, which actually started in 2009 when he was working for a small Salesforce partner in Sydney. He then moved to London, and we heard more about the early days of his Salesforce career in London and the kind of roles that he held and what the market was like in terms of finding opportunities in a market that was still emerging. We then hear a little bit more about his consulting journey initially and how he ended up with Tequila UK, a very well-known business that was acquired by Accenture a number of years ago, but a business that's had some real talent going through its doors. And it was really interesting to hear more about that journey. Cameron was one of Tequila's first CTAs, so we found out why the CTA journey appealed to him back then, what it was like and how he prepared, and ultimately what that full CTA journey was like for him. We talk more about Tequila and why they've had so many CTAs that have worked for them over the years, or people that have gone on to be CTAs, and what the environment was like and how that kind of fostered the architecture mindset and ultimately high performance and very, very strong architects that are now in the market and have gone on to great things. We talk a little bit about the role of an architect and how that's changed over the years from the early days. We look at when he knows someone is ready to be a CTA, perhaps some of the people that he's managed in the past. And then we look at actually managing large teams and coming from a technical background and if management actually came naturally to Cameron and if it's something that he instantly enjoyed or if it's something he had to work on. We look at what all the best architects do in comparison to others that are perhaps striving to get to the level they're at. And then the non-technical skills that Cameron looks for when interviewing team members. So really, really interesting chat. Cameron's a great guy. It was great to have him on the show. And I really enjoyed recording the episode. And hopefully you'll get a lot of value from it. And hopefully you're enjoying the episodes. And if you are, please do subscribe for future episodes that are coming through. So Cameron, thank you so much. I have an Aussie on the show and he's in London. So thank you for joining all the way from London today.
Hey Ben, thanks for having me.
So we've got a lot to run through. I'm really excited to hear more about your journey and kind of where you've gone over the years, what you've done and what's led you to this path you're on and where you are in your career now. So I always like to start looking backwards and to look back at the very early days and really understand what you wanted to be, what your plans were growing up and how you kind of landed in the world of IT.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've always been interested in computers, so it made complete sense for me to move into, I did an engineering degree at UTS in Sydney. And I guess coming out of that, kind of had an opportunity to look into the hardware sides of things or software sides of things. And I think at that point was just after the IT bubble in San Francisco. So it was kind of a point where there was so many things happening in the software space, and it kind of drew me to it because I think with all the craziness that was going on, there would also be quite a lot of opportunities. So I kind of focused more on the software side of the world. Yeah,
because I looked back at your profile, and I know we touched on this when we chatted before. You launched a product for the recruitment world. So was that around that kind of when everything was kicking off in San Francisco and the world was becoming really interested in the software piece? Was that kind of how that came about?
Yeah. I'd done some internships and, you know, I kind of was thinking definitely about, well, maybe it would be interesting to kind of start my own thing. So yeah, so I started to build, which is pretty relevant nowadays still, is like data mining. So I was doing a lot of data mining things. So LinkedIn was very new. There was a lot of stuff that was getting published. I think there was Zing was another kind of network that kind of fizzled out or whatnot. So what I was doing is I was using my software skills to basically create these scripts that would just go and just harvest data and then kind of structure it in a meaningful way, which then I would sell onto business development people and recruiters to kind of give them pipelines of candidates or potential customers.
Sure.
And that's how I got into it.
So when you were studying and in your early days, like your passion was development, did you see yourself as being like a career developer or was that always a step into something else?
I'd say at the time I was really interested in development, but I wasn't necessarily the best engineer, but I really enjoyed it. So I kind of saw myself as moving into more kind of like the business owner style of role. So understanding the concepts, managing engineering teams. But I think that was kind of the angle I went for. But then over time, I just spent more and more time, you know, really kind of getting into languages and getting into development. And that's kind of just naturally how I kind of moved into becoming like a developer in Salesforce.
Yeah. Sure. And just before we get to the Salesforce days, like looking back at your career in Australia, you did actually perform, like you did a BA stint, like a systems analyst, did a bit of project management. Was that by design or was that just you kind of fell into those roles or did you see that as beneficial to experience like a range of different responsibilities?
I kind of fell into those actually. I did an internship with a company which was looking at building software for the building industry. So what actually I became quite good at was actually going out and getting requirements. So going and talking to them about software, and it's kind of what I do somewhat today as well, is going out and talking about technology to people who may not be necessarily experts or SMEs in that space, and then taking that back and then converting that into software. It kind of wasn't kind of planned, it was just kind of something that just happened.
Yeah. Sure. And then you moved to London. Was that, you were straight to London from Sydney?
Yeah. I moved to the UK in about 2009. Yeah.
And was that, was your first role in London into the Salesforce world or did you do anything else in between?
No, I started doing some Salesforce work. So the data mining stuff, we had customers just like in the recruitment world who were probably pretty ahead of the times in regards to looking at Salesforce back in 2009. And what we would do is we'd scrape all this data and they would ask us like, hey, could you deploy this into Salesforce? Because there wasn't really many Salesforce practices back then. And there definitely wasn't many Salesforce developers. And so what we'd do is we would get these data sets and we eventually started figuring out that actually the money was actually much better on the Salesforce side. So what we started doing was we basically spent all this time doing this really intense data mining activities and kind of some very early data science kind of things. And then we'd spend 2 or 3 days just putting to Salesforce and we would get paid more for the Salesforce work. So after time, we started kind of ramping down on the data science and started just doing more and more Salesforce spaces. Yeah.
So was it, I often ask this question and some people actually it was and some people it really wasn't, but love at first sight, I guess, when you saw Salesforce in action. Was it something you could see that you were going to spend a considerable amount of time working with?
Yeah, I had a pretty good introduction to Salesforce. So obviously it was that side. Then I joined a company called Pullman, which was very early days. It'd been acquired a few times and eventually became Blue Wolf in APAC. And I was the first hire there. So I got a really good introduction to it in regards to being like thrown really in the deep end and started doing some really cool stuff. And because there was a lot of stuff that you could do on the platform at that stage, it was all very new, like Visual Force just came out. Apex was still kind of not as well known, definitely in engineering circles. I was able to like progress really quickly. So rather than go for like a very structured type of career, I was kind of thrown in the deep end and was able to spend a lot of time by myself kind of figuring out how to do things, which I found really interesting. And then secondly, I was able to move in and start working with very senior people very early on. So yeah.
So Hallman, did that then become Vertic?
Yeah,
those Patrick and
Ryan and those guys. Oh, Barry, right. Yeah.
I had no idea. Like I know Patrick really well, but I had no idea that you were part of that business.
Yeah. Well, I think on my hiring, I basically told Ryan, I was like, listen, I'm either going to compete with you or we can team up. And luckily we kind of teamed up and. It was a very good introduction into kind of professional services work within Salesforce.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, because I've done a podcast with Patrick before. They were like the early Salesforce partners here. There were those guys and one other that then
SquarePeg, I think.
Well, yeah. So there was SquarePeg, and then there were the guys that got acquired by Deloitte, and it was Chris Mal and David and those guys. Yeah. That's crazy. I had no idea. So then you went over to London and I'm guessing that's when you landed in Tequila?
No. So I spent the first year contracting just to kind of figure out if I was going to stay. So I did a year just doing the contract gig kind of scene, which was fun. It was a good like first year to kind of, you know, not so serious, but, doing some pretty meaningful work and just building up skill set. Yeah, then I joined Blue Wolf actually. There was about five people in the UK at that time. So I joined Blue Wolf, which was an amazing experience, and spent a year leading the technical team there. Yeah, then after that, I got into some conversations, and which led to kind of setting up the Salesforce practice in Tequila. So it's building up the professional services and eventually the managed service aspects as well.
Sure. Yeah. So just touching on the contracting days, was it easy to get a job back then? Was there a lot of demand?
Easy. Absolutely easy, yeah. You could put something out on LinkedIn and within an hour you'd have, there were so many jobs for Salesforce developers and architects. I think it's still pretty easy these days, right? Like there's such a demand for skills, like for decent developers and architects. But yeah, back then you could literally have a job within a day. Yeah, it was very easy.
So was the market just kicking off, like everyone was at that point moving from Siebel to Salesforce in London, and that's kind of what was driving it? Or was it just this new product that was kind of taking the market by storm, startups using it, that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, I think VisualForce had just come out, like 2009, around 2009, I think it was. Yeah, so you had companies who may have had Salesforce as part of their CRM solution, but then all of a sudden it became, well, I can actually build other business applications on it. So you had these companies who were investing really heavily to build out things that they may have done in, you know, Siebel Worlds or whatnot, or SAP, which nowadays we kind of probably look back and go, that's definitely not the way you implement Salesforce. But yeah, there was just a lot of demand. And then obviously obsolescence, you had like Siebel kind of implementations, SAP CRM, dynamics where people were trying to move off those and to get onto Salesforce. So there was a lot of greenfield. There's a lot of places where Salesforce had been in for a few years, but they were looking to expand their use into other use cases as well. Yeah,
sure. And I'm always fascinated when I speak to someone that was at Tequila, but you were really early days Tequila, right?
Yeah. So Wes Noltier, you might know. I'm not sure if you're familiar with him. And so we'd been kind of, I guess, acquaintances in the ecosystem in the UK. He's from South Africa. I'm from Australia. So I think he came over like maybe a year or two before me. So we kind of were just in contact. And he was approached by a recruitment firm, actually, and they were looking to set up a Salesforce practice. But I think the challenges they had is that they hadn't had anyone, had contractors, had some really good guys, but none of them actually done professional services before. So they didn't really understand the methodology, how you contracted, you know, how you kind of built teams or whatnot. So I had my experience within Australia with Holman and working with Salesforce Professional Services, had done some time with Blue Wolf, which was kind of like a whirlwind of kind of getting pulled left, right, and center. So learn a real lot there. So I came across to basically set up the PS organization, the professional services, so moving away from just kind of body shop contracting style of works and kind of set up a proper kind of professional services organization. And I came across with my sales executive from Blue Wolf. So he set up all the sales organization as well. Again, not going after contracts or going after kind of body shop, but actually kind of really pitching into organizations. Yeah.
So was that at the time, was the market quite heavy on the kind of staff augmentation, body shopping? Were there other real Salesforce practices apart from Blue Wolf and taking shape at that point?
You had a few. Yeah. I mean, it was definitely a period where things were starting to pop up. So there were a few kind of guys who've been around for a period of time who may have came from the Siebel world and just kind of moved across technologies and stuff like that, as you mentioned before. So there were some people there, but I think why we were really successful at Tequila is that it was a little bit maybe old school in how they kind of approach things. So I think what made us really successful is we kind of came out with a pace and I guess like a marketing message and technical excellence, which is kind of really what we were known for. Yeah.
So how did that role evolve? Because yeah, you were early in the process. I think yourself and Wes were the two first CTAs within the business. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So CTA came, I can't even remember. I think it was 2012, 2013, I think. And I think this is what drove and scared a lot of people back in the time is that, so if your organization was to become a platinum partner, you had to have a CTA. So that was kind of like a mandated thing. So you had all these practices who were busy as they were, right? So just delivering client projects. Then all of a sudden, like me and Wes were essentially like, well, we need to get CTA. We become CTA. What is a CTA, first of all? And then why do we need to become it? It's like, okay, we need to be platinum partner for recognition within the industry. And then, yeah, we had like about 3 to 6 months. We had some support. But it was a pretty grueling time. So we went through, I think, on the first or second set of boards in the UK. That was a lot of late nights.
Yeah. So were you still at that time, you were heavily involved in architecture on projects that you were hands-on still at that point, even though you were managing the professional services stream, you were building out that team, right? And quite aggressively, but you were able to pass the CTA because you were kind of, you were still very much hands-on doing what you needed to be doing on the platform.
Very. Yeah. I think at Tequila, I think one of the cool things was, is that everyone was very hands-on. So even though me and Wes, moved into the CTO role, I became the innovation officer. We were definitely really hands-on. So I was involved with helping open up offices. So I spent some time in Japan, kind of like building up kind of practice, the international practice there. Spent a lot of time in Shanghai with some large customers that we had done some deals with. But yeah, it was very much in the architecture, really kind of, even at that stage, I was still kind of looking at like coding, doing code reviews and things like that as well. So, yeah.
So what?
Yeah, very hands-on.
What made tequila so special? Because like I've had a number of CTAs on the podcast that have been through tequila and come out the other end with passing the review board, but also setting up companies. And yeah, there's seems to be this thing about people that work for Tequila UK that have, it's kind of been a launch pad for so many people. So you mentioned people still being hands-on, but what, mm-hmm. what was it that kind of set you as a business apart from others?
Yeah, I would say that I think at the leadership level, we really kind of valued technical expertise. I think that was a really important thing for us. So even from the day one, like, you know, sales was important, delivery was important. And I think sometimes special services agencies can sometimes be a little bit too heavy on the sales and delivery sides of it, with kind of a lesser importance on the technical side. But from day one, that was the thing. We wanted to look at the big hairy problems within the Salesforce ecosystem, so challenging projects and whatnot. And we really try to push our guys, like, so as a, like all our senior guy technical teams were really hands-on, were doing what they were, you know, asking their reports to be doing. And I think there was really this kind of push, and because we had such a good group of architects who were leading all these really interesting projects, it just fostered this community of like innovation and like, you know, looking at how we could do really cool things. And a lot of those guys also had their own blogs. They were really passionate about specific things, like Lorenzo, who went off to do Clayton, and Nicholas Tassini, who went off to do native video. So you had all these guys doing all these different things, but it was this kind of like this group of guys you could trust to ask, like, hey, I got this specific problem. And then you'd have someone, hey, I've actually experienced that before. This is how you deal with it. So it really kind of, I think as a cohort, everyone kind of pushed themselves forward. I can't remember. I think we ended up with like 20 or 30% of the CTAs in Europe at one point, just because where I think other practices were, as like, oh, I have to become a CTA. It actually became a really important thing. So guys really wanted to do it. And, you know, we invested the time and the effort to support their ambitions to become CTAs.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And it definitely worked. It was, like I said, it's just crazy to see what people have gone on to do. And when speaking with them, it seems everyone has fond memories of working there as well, which isn't always the thing when you speak about professional services and consulting. It's not always a positive experience, right? But
yeah,
it seems to have been that.
Well, yeah, hindsight's always rosier. I mean, it definitely wasn't perfect. We definitely screwed up a lot of things. And there were some times on projects where you're like, I have no idea how we're going to get out of this, or, you know, how we're going to resolve these problems. But yeah, I think it's those types of things where you have that autonomy to fail and to kind of improve that really kind of, when you look back at it, go, actually, these are pretty defining moments that made me the engineer, the architect, the business owner that I am today.
Sure. Yeah. So you mentioned Japan, and I know you spent a fair bit of time in Japan, and you, mm-hmm. I have never spoken to anyone else in the Japanese market, and I've mm-hmm. heard that it's a growth market, but how different was it for you going over there and doing business there? Like, architecture is the same, right? But your approach and everything else had to change, or?
Yeah, Japan was a very interesting experience. So a bit of backstory. So I'd been there before. So I'd lived there for 2 years prior to Tequila going there. And one of the great things about Tequila is we had a really good investor, a guy called James McHugh, who used to do K2 and a bunch of other things. And he had connections in Japan. We were able to partner with a really big company called Persona, which is kind of a recruitment company, but recruitment's kind of different in Japan. It's not kind of how you would see it in Australia or UK. And yeah, so we went across there to set up the practice. So it was myself, Bashir, Sebastian Wagner, Laurent, and there was a kind of a core team. So we had, you know, Bash, who was looking at the project management sides, how to set up the practice governance around that. Sebastian, who was one of our kind of key developers, amazing guy, and he would go out and kind of figure out how we'd build these things, because there was definitely some different ways of doing things in Japan. And Laurent as well was kind of supporting that. And then my job was to kind of work on the sales side of things, so supporting the team there, helping kind of get the practices set up across the board, and then obviously doing some of the architecture pieces with the architects and customers there. But it's very different. I think you'd have some meetings where we'd come in and it would all be Japanese, and, you know, we would just sit there and, like, at the end of it, like, did I really contribute to this? But it's always the after stuff, so that you'd explain, you know, our sales leads or business analysts would explain to me what they discussed or whatever. But it was just, there's definitely a different cultural aspect to things.
Yeah.
One of the craziest things there is I went to university in Japan, and one time I was just about to leave to come back to the UK, and we got this lead that came in for a university in a specific area of Japan. I was like, hang on, wait a minute. And it was the university I had went to. So I'd actually went back to my university and we actually won the deal. But it was quite weird going from being a student to now going back and talking to the dean of that about implementing Salesforce. And I didn't tell them till like maybe 2 days or 3 days in because I wasn't my grades weren't so good. So I didn't want to kind of turn them off on the deal. So I told them a few days later and they completely forgot who I was. And they went back and they're like, that was a pretty fun experience.
So yeah. Waited until you'd got the deal signed before you let them know who you were.
Oh, yeah. I definitely want to see my card before then.
Yeah, yeah. So are you still still involved in global pieces of work now? And is Japan still somewhere that you're doing some work?
I rarely talk to about Accenture now, which was acquired Tequila about 5-6 years ago. And yeah, I talk to the Japanese organization very rarely. I mean, I'd love to, but it's just not feasible right now too. There's so much stuff. So my remit right now is Europe. Mm-hmm. There's so much stuff that's happening there. So not directly. We still do sometimes work with global customers who will have a Japanese business unit and you're having like org discussions or, you know, data residency type of discussions and things like that. But yeah, not hands-on in market anymore.
Sure.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Yeah. So obviously you're one of the, I think it's fair to say, veterans of Salesforce architecture now. Like there aren't many people that have the amount of architecture experience you have, based on the fact that you were architecturing solutions back in 2009 onwards. So what's changed about being an architect? Like from then to now, what's kind of changed about the role of an architect in the Salesforce ecosystem?
Good question. I think the scope of the work that you kind of look at in a project these days is much wider. So I think if you look at 2009, we had Apex and S controls and a whole bunch of stuff that you could do, but it was all kind of a little bit hacky. VisualForce came along and I was like, wow, this is like a whole new language you need to learn. I was like, how are we going to get our heads around this? Yeah, you know, and then, you know, within a few months to then go out and kind of consult on it. So that was kind of the thing. You had Apex, you had like the core Salesforce platform, you had some visualization things that you could do, but it was pretty limited. But at the time, it seemed quite a lot, right, as you're learning it. But now this, your considerations are much wider, right? Like you're thinking about, okay, because Salesforce has acquired so many companies and different technologies, and sometimes it gets lost in the marketing message how connected these platforms are. So you can spend a lot of time just trying to figure out how would I get this into, you know, the CDP solution? How would I get a MuleSoft layer? How do I design it in a way that I can reuse it? How can I design parts of Salesforce that can then take in managed packages? So I think the architecture has got a lot more complicated. And I think as technology has evolved as well, is the types of platforms as well that you're integrating into. So using event buses and these types of things become a lot more kind of common. So I think for an architect, it's kind of overwhelming. And I think Salesforce has kind of acknowledged that and kind of split the domain. So if you look now, they're bringing out a certification around B2B architecture and B2C architecture, which kind of complements the CTA, because CTA is really hands in the details, kind of coding, kind of understanding kind of specific platform, how you implement things, where architecture is looking at how the platforms all connect together. So I think you're seeing that divergence of roles. So you're seeing people who are taking the CTA path and becoming really kind of technical, hands-on type of kind of resources. And then you've seen other people who move into the architecture space, which is just trying to figure out like all the Salesforce clouds, how they connect together, those types of things. So I think the roles kind of got a lot broader. Yeah.
This episode of Talent Hub Talk is sponsored by our friends from Flow Republic. Flow Republic is a Salesforce architect academy that works with individuals and businesses to upskill and prepare Salesforce architects for the CTA review board. They also have a number of other offerings, including coaching and guiding on areas such as soft skills, consulting, and design training. Flow Republic are some of the brightest minds in the Salesforce ecosystem and have a proven track record of developing Salesforce professionals and helping architects to reach their goal of becoming a CTA. To find out more about the value they can add, please check out flowrepublic.com.
So how do you know when someone is ready to be an architect? And let's say a CTA, right? So you've led teams, you've had other, in the Tequila days, you've had people reporting through that have gone on to become CTAs. Like, what is it that you're looking for in someone that you can say, this is someone that's going to progress to a CTA and has the ability to go for it now?
Yeah. I was also selling the boards as well. So I used to be a judge for APAC. So I did some of the boards in Japan, which is quite interesting. And then also in Europe as well. And then obviously running a CTA academy, you know, with Wes back at Tequila days and then started at Accenture. I think the drive to want to do it, I think it's one of those exams where if you're not really committed to do it, you're not going to get through it. just because there is such a wealth of knowledge that you need to get your hands on to be able to really quickly kind of bring back, just because of the shape of how the exam is done. So I think the person's interest in doing it, I think that's the key thing, their attitude to it. So, you know, we've had some guys who have gone, there's absolutely no way you're going to do this, but they've been so persistent. They haven't had the right background. They haven't had the right projects. And then over a year or two, they've kind of focused on being on the right projects, making sure that they were studying. You know, we had one guy who's quite a prominent blogger now within the Salesforce space, who I think every morning he'd do 2 hours, like every day of the week, 2 hours. But I think it was like a year and a half or something like that. And it's just that kind of drive and persistence, I think, and that just interest in technology to understand how it works and how it comes together, I think is what gets people through. I think certain people have just have the right aptitude. Are just very intelligent, but I think they're rare. I think what really drives someone to come from C2 is their attitude and their ability to sit down and put together a structured plan of how they're going to move towards that goal.
Sure. Yeah, it's really interesting some of the lengths that people now go to for the journey that they're trying to achieve. Like I did a podcast with a guy, Johan, in Germany. He took a year off work to study for the CTA.
Yeah.
And it's like that, like you said, it's the desire to get there, because to do that, right, you're fully in. Like there's no second thought. Like you're committed to achieving that goal.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the key thing is if you're interested in taking the CTA, I think understand why do you want to become a CTA first of all, right? Is it just because it's a badge that you want to get? Because I think that may not be the right reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think the other thing is that working with your organization, I think generally most professional service organizations love like the concept of having CTAs or multiple CTAs. So if you go to them with a plan to say, look, hey, I'm not there now, I'm maybe a developer or maybe I'm a business analyst and I want to move towards that path, I think working with them to make sure you're on the right projects, because that really drives a lot of it. A lot of the CTA is about, it's very important, don't get me wrong, it's very important to understand the scope of the materials that you need to study. It's very important. But a lot of the questions the judges will ask are kind of based on experience. And they want to kind of see that you've implemented some of these things in practice. So the project experience, being able to have the scars to be able to talk about some of these topics, is really important. So that project experience becomes kind of fundamental to getting through as well.
Yeah. Sure. So having sat on the review board a few times, was it quite obvious to you quite quickly when someone would start their presentation or whatever the format is? Like, did you sense really early on if someone was going to pass or fail just on how they would start and how they would approach their delivery?
Yeah, there's some people you instantly knew were just not going to be successful. And it's not because of the way that they're kind of communicating, not at all. It was more about because you jump straight into it, right, into the presentation. And you can kind of see how they've kind of constructed their presentation of how they think about a specific problem or how they would tackle this in like a real life scenario. Because remember, like the CTA is kind of representing like an RFP from a customer, right? And that gave you kind of very good kind of insight into where they were in regards to their journey to become a CTA. And sometimes you'd see the presentation, you'd be like, you're not really kind of thinking about this in a structured way. You're not really kind of seeing the key things that we're expecting you to do. The other one is you'd have guys who would come in and kind of to the point about experience who'd learned all the materials. So you go through the presentation, you're like, this guy's absolute shoo-in. Like there's no way this guy is not going to be able to get through, because very structured, articulate, really kind of concise, great diagrams, captured everything. But as soon as you got to questions and you asked them, okay, well, how would you change this? They would just fall apart because they had all the technical knowledge, but they'd never implemented it before. Or a big part of it is being able to defend your solutions, right? As an architect, you go into a customer, I'd probably say 8 times out of 10, someone's going to raise an objection or want to understand a little bit more about your thinking. And unless you can defend that, you know, credibly, then it's you're gonna really struggle. And so you saw some candidates who would fail on that side of things.
Yeah. Sure, I put a post on LinkedIn recently about, is there actually demand for CTAs? Like, because people are striving, for it, but you know, it's rare for someone to be like, we have to hire a CTA. It's quite common that like someone's hiring for an architect, and if there is a CTA, they'll absolutely hire them. Or if a CTA becomes available, the company will make a role for them. And Sebastian Wagner made a good point and said, like, just having the badge, there are so many architects in the world that are amazing, that are equally as good as a CTA, and in some cases stronger. but like it's not the right setup for them in terms of going about it in the structure that you have to pass the CTA review board, or they just don't want to. So from your experience, CTA aside, what do all of the really amazing architects you've ever worked with, what makes them so special?
It's a good question as well. Yeah, I think I said before, right? So the CTA is just one part of it. It does define someone in maybe a recruiting sense. Like, so it's kind of like a badge to say, okay, this person has passed this extremely hard exam. And I think for some employers, that's important because they need that tick for some reason. Yeah, it may be because they need to kind of have a partner status, or it's maybe a prestige thing or whatever. Yeah, so I think of the organizations, struggle sometimes to attract CTAs, and when they do, it's quite expensive to do so. So they're not types of roles, and I don't think people move that often as well, because I think they're hard to attract. Usually when they're somewhere, they're usually locked in quite well. You definitely get a lot of job offers. I think if you're a CTA, they may not be published, but you do get a lot of things coming through to you directly, usually because people will know you or have heard of you or something like that. I think the architects that I've been most impressed with, I think it hasn't been the technical wizards, right? So I work with a lot of CTAs who are just phenomenal technologists, and everything they say, you know, it's going to be spot on. You can go look at the reference manual. They know exactly what they're talking about. But I think the ones that are really, really impressed and left an impression on me have been the ones who've been able to kind of bridge the divide between technical and communication skills. So being able to have a really articulate conversation with someone who's completely not technical, right? So you might be talking to VP of sales. You might be talking to an enterprise architect who's not really au fait with Salesforce, may actually be trying to kind of bring it down in regards to the process they're in. So they may not be so keen to look at it for whatever reason. And it's the architects there who are able to have those kind of difficult conversations, but while still kind of supporting a technical solution, I think what I've been really impressed. Yeah. So I think it's that combination between the two skills. So I think you can be a really great communicator, but if your technical knowledge isn't great, you may kind of sell in whatever you're trying to sell in, but actually what you're selling in may not actually work, or may not be the right thing. And then vice versa, right? You could have this amazing, phenomenal solution. And I think this actually trips up a lot of architects, is that you kind of see the right answer and how to do it, but you have a real hard time conveying that across to saying why a company should invest in this or do it this way.
Sure.
So having a foot in both is really kind of what makes an architect impressive in my books.
Yeah, nice. I like the angle of the ability to communicate that technology back to the customer, because that must be 90% of the battle, right? Just you knowing the solution works isn't going to get you anywhere. It's about how you actually get that across the boardroom and make sure everyone understands.
Yeah, exactly. And it's difficult, right? Like, you think about it, like you put yourself in their set. If you're a VP of sales, like, you're thinking about forecasts, like sales strategies and these types of things. And you've got some guy in front of you talking about, we're going to connect your pipeline into your order management solution, or we're going to use an event bus. And he doesn't understand your world. You don't understand his world. And you guys need to find a common ground first for him to sign off the work to say, okay, I trust you. This is how I want my system to work. You tell me how that actually happens, you know. And I think that building that kind of trust is not just on technical capability, but it's also the communication and the human aspects of it as well.
Sure. Leadership is another skill set, right? Not everyone has the ability or the desire to lead. You have managed teams and you still manage teams, right?
Yeah.
So when at the beginning of the conversation, you wanted to be a technologist, like you were interested in software, you loved development, but you did want to kind of take the journey into more of a like business ownership role or leading teams. Did that step come naturally to you when you first started leading? And kind of what have you learned about yourself along that journey to make you a better leader?
I think initially I wasn't a very good leader. I think if you ask some of my colleagues from some of my earlier jobs where I was managing, I was a bit of a dictator. I kind of saw things in my way of doing things. So I was like, and I think that was obviously from coming from a position of doing it, right? So I'd done the role. I then moved up. I had people sitting underneath me. And I kind of expected them to see the problem and to tackle the problem in the same that I would. And I think I just don't think I'm the best leader, but I think how I've developed as a leader is kind of understanding a little bit about, you need to kind of give people kind of latitude, the freedom, the autonomy to kind of approach things in their own way. And I think as a leader, your responsibility is to kind of help them and try to make them as successful as possible. And part of that actually may be to let them fail sometimes. So you may see what they're trying to do, and sometimes the worst thing to do is to kind of jump in and try to, you know, take over the piece, because that essentially demotivates that person, right? So if you jump in, kind of take ownership of it, they kind of lose their kind of like ownership of the problem or what they're doing. And so you end up then just kind of end up in a situation where you're doing the work, not really leading. And then now you've got a disenfranchised kind of report who just feels kind of like you'll keep jumping in and kind of, you know, micromanaging. So I think how I've developed as a leader is trying to not so much lead from the front. I think there's definitely a part of like kind of doing evangelism and kind of knowing your stuff. And I think that's important. So being, you want to be someone that's knowledgeable, but I think the key thing is being able to be kind of a leader from a supportive angle. So kind of having a team, letting them do their thing and then supporting them where you can. And I think just also being more human about it. I think when you're kind of a young leader, you kind of have these kind of views and you kind of see these kind of self-help guys on LinkedIn telling you these are the 5 steps to leadership of blah, blah, blah. And you kind of get influenced a little bit by that. And you try to just, as you're trying to figure out that domain, try to take some of that in. But then over time, you realize what's important is the human side of it, is sure. Kind of realizing people are people and how you support them best. Yeah.
That's a hard thing to do though, right? In terms of stepping back and letting people make mistakes, especially when you are like, you're truly kicking goals and you're at the kind of pinnacle of, at that time, the early days of Salesforce even, and then leading, you're already a CTA, like you've achieved what people will go on for years to come to want to achieve. And it must be so hard just to take a step back and let people make mistakes because you know the answer, right?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a maturity thing. I think it's definitely one of those things that's hard to kind of get your head around initially. And it's definitely hard to explain, especially to your leadership as well, because, you know, you've got a CEO you're reporting into. It's like, why is this X, Y, and Z happened with this, blah, blah, blah. I thought you were across this. And trying to explain that, like, listen, you know, we needed to kind of get to that to get to a fix. So that definitely becomes difficult to manage, but it's definitely the right approach, and it's definitely something that I think that makes me a better leader as of today. Yeah.
So how can someone impress you in an interview?
I think not trying to bullshit me. I think that's definitely kind of something that kind of is annoying. So if you're good at what you do, then show me through your knowledge, or show me through, you know, what skill set you have, whether it's in sales or whether it's pre-sales or consulting or whatnot. So I think being clear, having an audit of what you do well and be able to articulate that. I think also kind of calling, I think one of the key things is actually showing what you want to do. So why do you want to be in a role? A lot of times you'll interview someone senior and for his position, and they won't really have a clear reason, or they just want the job, and that's completely fine. But I think what really makes a great architect, or I think in any position, right, a business analyst, developer, whatever, is actually having an ambition. Maybe like, hey, I really want to become a CTA. I think that's a really good one. Or even if it's not a CTA, if like, I just really want to do, I really enjoy coding. And I think, you know, in the organization you're in, it's going to be a great opportunity for me to work on some really challenging, difficult things. So I think it's having a reason of why you want to do a job. I think that's really important. Yeah.
And do you, I know obviously there are certain questions everyone should know the answer to, right, if they're applying for a certain role, but would you rather, when you say don't bullshit, would you rather someone just, if they don't know the answer, they're straight up, they don't know the answer, but they tell you how they would solve the problem, or they'd find out the answer to the question?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. So I think the key isn't to bullshit, to basically say, oh, this is how I deal with it. But it's also not to do the other thing as well, right, which is, I'd say, I have no idea. I think it's a case of exactly as you called out, is like, how would you get to that? So how would I approach this problem? So, okay, so I don't know how to do that, but, you know, this is how I would think about it based on how I've tackled other issues. Or it's like one of those things, if you're in a technical exam and they listen, like, listen, I can't recall exactly what methods I'd need to do that, but this is how I would do. I'd go to Google. I'd Google AppExchange kind of like API guide reference, and then I'd find the method to do it, and that's how I do it. And I think if you're honest about those types of things, I think then that's fine. Actually, I'd appreciate someone who does that, because in reality, a lot of those things you do in exams, you're not going to really need to recite on the spot anyway. It's like you go and check a manual, or you figure out, you ask someone about. So yeah.
I had someone in an interview, they got asked a question like that, and their answer was, I don't remember the stuff that it would be quicker for me to Google.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a good answer. I think it's Yeah, like it was something about governor limits or, and they were like, look, things like that. Like I've only got so much capacity in my brain to remember, but I can Google the answer to that. So final question, when are you coming back mm-hmm. to Australia?
Oh man, that'd be great. I'd love to come. Right now, I'm not willing to do the 2-week lockdown in the hotel. So I think as soon as that comes down, things are a bit more safe to travel. I definitely need to come back for a few months, hopefully in the summer periods. Yeah.
Get away from that cold English winter that you've got ahead of you.
As I'm sure you're very familiar with.
I sure am. Yeah, I sure am. But yeah. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the chat. And for anyone that does want to reach out and pick your brains on anything we've discussed today or hear more about you or anything really, where's the best place for them to contact you?
Yeah, just LinkedIn. Yeah. So Cameron Cronin at LinkedIn, probably the best spot to hit me up.
Yeah, perfect. Well, look, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the chat and I'm really sure our audience will too. So thank you and enjoy the winter.
Great. Thanks, Ben.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Talent Hub Talk. If you're enjoying the podcast, we'd love it if you could subscribe and also leave a short review. We're keen for this podcast to reach as many people in the Salesforce ecosystem as possible, and your reviews will help us do that.